The Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell. Off there to the right somewhere is a large island, said Whitney. It's rather a mystery. What island is it? Ransford asked. The old charts call it Ship Trap Island, Whitney replied. A suggestive name, isn't it? Sailors have a curious dread of the place. I don't know why, some superstition. Can't see it, remarked Ransford, trying to peer through the dank tropical night. That was palpable as it pressed its thick, warm blackness in upon the yacht. You've good eyes, said Whitney with a laugh, and I've seen you pick off a moose moving in the brown fall brush at 400 yards. But even you can't see 4 miles or so through a moonless Caribbean night. Not 4 yards, admitted Ransford. Ugh, it's like moist black velvet. It will be light in Rio, promised Whitney. We should make it in a few days. I hope the Jaguar guns have come from Purdy's. We should have some good hunting up the Amazon, good sport hunting. The best sport in the world, agreed Ransford. For the hunter, amended Whitney, not for the Jaguar. Don't talk rot, Whitney, said Ransford. You're a big game hunter, not a philosopher. Who cares how a Jaguar feels? Perhaps the Jaguar does, observed Whitney. Bah! They've no understanding. Even so, I rather think they understand one thing, fear. The fear of pain and the fear of death. Nonsense, laughed Ransford. This hot weather is making you soft, Whitney. Be a realist. The world is made up of 2 classes, the hunters and the huntees. Luckily, you and I are hunters. Do you think we've passed that island yet? I can't tell in the dark. I hope so. Why? Asked Ransford. The place has a reputation, a bad one. Cannibals? Suggested Ransford. Hardly. Even cannibals wouldn't live in such a godforsaken place. But it's gotten into sailor lore somehow. Didn't you notice that the crew's nerves seemed a bit jumpy today? They were a bit strange, now you mention it. Even Captain Nielsen. Yes, even that tough-minded old Swede who'd go up to the devil himself and ask him for a light. Those fishy blue eyes held a look I never saw there before. All I could get out of him was, "This place has an evil name among seafaring men, sir." Then he said to me, very gravely, "Don't you feel anything?" As if the air about us was actually poisonous. Now, you mustn't laugh when I tell you this. I did feel something like a sudden chill. There was no breeze. The sea was as flat as a plate of glass window. We were drawing near the island then. What I felt was a mental chill, a sort of sudden dread. Pure imagination, said Ransford. One superstitious sailor can taint the whole ship's company with his fear. Maybe, but sometimes I think sailors have an extra sense that tells them when they are in danger. Sometimes I think evil is a tangible thing, with wavelengths, just as sound and light have. An evil place can, so to speak, broadcast vibrations of evil anyhow. I'm glad we're getting out of the zone. Well, think I'll turn in now, Ransford. I'm not sleepy, said Ransford. I'm going to smoke another pipe up on the after deck. Good night, then, Ransford. See you at breakfast. Right. Good night, Whitney. There was no sound in the night as Ransford sat there, but the muffled throb of the engine that drove the yacht swiftly through the darkness and the swish and ripple of the wash of the propeller. Ransford, reclining in a steamer chair, indolently puffed on his favorite briar. The sensuous drowsiness of the night was on him. It's so dark, he thought, that I could sleep without closing my eyes. The night would be my eyelids. An absurd sound startled him. Off to the right he heard it, and his ears, expert in such matters, could not be mistaken. Again he heard the sound, and again, somewhere off in the blackness, someone had fired a gun 3 times. Ransford sprang up and moved quickly to the rail, mystified. He strained his eyes in the direction from which the report had come, but it was like trying to see through a blanket. He leaped upon the rail and balanced himself there to get greater elevation. His pipe, striking a rope, was knocked from his mouth. He lunged for it. A short, hoarse cry came from his lips as he realized he had reached too far and had lost his balance. The cry was pinched off short as the blood-warm waters of the Caribbean Sea closed over his head. He struggled up to the surface and tried to cry out, but the wash from the speeding yacht splashed him in the face, and the salt water in his open mouth made him gag and strangle. Desperately, he struck out with strong strokes after the receding lights of the yacht, but he stopped before he had swum 50 feet. A certain cold-headedness had come to him. It was not the first time he'd been in a tight place. There was a chance that his cries could be heard by someone aboard the yacht, but that chance was slender, and grew more slender as the yacht raced on. He wrestled himself out of his clothes and shouted with all his power. The lights of the yacht became faint and ever-vanishing fireflies. Then they were blotted out entirely by the night. Ransford remembered the shots. They had come from the right, and doggedly he swam in that direction, swimming with slow, deliberate strokes, conserving his strength. For a seemingly endless time, he fought the sea. He began to count his strokes, and he could do possibly 100 more, and then... Ransford heard a sound. It came out of the darkness, a high, screaming sound, the sound of an animal in an extremity of anguish and terror. He did not recognize the animal that made the sound. He did not try to. With fresh vitality, he swam toward the sound. He heard it again. Then it was cut short by another noise, crisp, staccato. "Pistol shot," muttered Ransford, swimming on. 10 minutes of determined effort brought another sound to his ears, the most welcome he had ever heard, the muttering and growling of the sea breaking on a rocky shore. He was almost on the rocks before he saw them. On a night less calm, he would have been shattered against them. With his remaining strength, he dragged himself from the swirling waters. Jagged crags appeared to jut into the opaqueness. He forced himself upward, hand over hand, gasping, his hands raw. He reached a flat place at the top. Dense jungle came down to the very edge of the cliffs. What perils that tangle of trees and the underbrush might hold for him did not concern Ransford just then. All he knew was that he was safe from his enemy, the sea, and that utter weariness was on him. He flung himself down at the jungle edge and tumbled headlong into the deepest sleep of his life. When he opened his eyes, he knew from the position of the sun that it was late in the afternoon. Sleep had given him new vigor. A sharp hunger was picking at him. He looked about him almost cheerfully. "Where there are pistol shots, there are men. Where there are men, there is food," he thought. But what kind of men, he wondered, and so forbiddening a place. An unbroken front of snarled and jagged jungle fringed the shore. He saw no sign of a trail through the closely knit web of weeds and trees. It was easier to go along the shore, and Ransford floundered along the water. Not far from where he had landed, he stopped. Some wounded thing, by the evidence, a large animal, had thrashed about in the underbrush. The jungle weeds were crushed down, and the moss was lacerated. One patch of weeds was stained crimson. A small glittering object not far away caught Ransford's eye, and he picked it up. It was an empty cartridge. "A 22," he remarked. "That's odd. It must have been a fairly large animal, too. The hunter had his nerve to tackle it with a light gun. It's clear that the brute put up a fight. I suppose the first 3 shots I heard was when the hunter flushed his quarry and wounded it. The last shot was when he trailed it here and finished it." He examined the ground closely and found what he had hoped to find, the print of a hunting boot. They pointed along the cliff in the direction he had been going. Eagerly he hurried along, now slipping on a rotten log or a loose stone, but making headway. Night was beginning to settle down on the island. Bleak darkness was blacking out the sea and jungle when Ransford sighted the lights. He came upon them as he turned a crook in the coastline, and his first thought was that he had come upon a village, for there were many lights. But as he forged along, he saw, to his great astonishment, that all the lights were in one enormous building, a lofty structure with pointed towers plunging upward into the gloom. His eyes made out the shadowy outlines of a palatial chateau. It was set on a high bluff, and on 3 sides of it, cliffs dived down to where the sea licked greedy lips in the shadows. Mirage, thought Ransford. But it was no mirage, he found, when he opened the tall spiked iron gate. The stone steps were real enough. The massive door with a leering gargoyle for a knocker was real enough. Yet, about it all hung an air of unreality. He lifted the knocker, and it creaked up stiffly as if it had never before been used. He let it fall, and it startled him with its booming loudness. He thought he heard steps within. The door remained closed. Again Ransford lifted the heavy knocker, and it let it fall. The door opened then, opened as suddenly as if it were on a spring, and Ransford stood blinking in the river of glaring gold light that poured out. The first thing Ransford's eyes discerned was the largest man Ransford had ever seen, a gigantic creature, a solidly made and black-bearded to the waist. In his hand the man held a long-barreled revolver, and he was pointing it straight at Ransford's heart. Out of the snarl of beard, small eyes regarded Ransford. "Don't be alarmed," said Ransford with a smile which he hoped was disarming. "I'm no robber. I fell off a yacht. My name is Sanger Ransford of New York City." The menacing look in his eyes did not change. The revolver pointed as rigidly as if the giant were a statue. He gave no sign that he understood Ransford's words, or that he had even heard them. He was dressed in uniform, a black uniform trimmed with gray astrakhan. "I'm Sanger Ransford of New York," Ransford began again. "I fell off a yacht. I'm hungry." The man's only answer was to raise with his thumb the hammer of his revolver. Then Ransford saw the man's free hand go to his forehead in a military salute, and he saw him click his heels together and stand at attention. Another man was coming down the broad marble steps, an erect, slender man in evening clothes. He advanced to Ransford and held out his hand. In a cultivated voice, marked by a slight accent that gave it added precision and deliberateness, he said, "It is a very great pleasure and honor to welcome Mr. Sanger Ransford, the celebrated hunter, to my home." Automatically, Ransford shook the man's hand. "I've read your books about hunting snow leopards in Tibet, you see," explained the man. "I am General Zaroff." Ransford's first impression was that the man was singularly handsome. His second was that there was an original, almost bizarre quality about the general's face. He was a tall man, past middle age, for his hair was a vivid white, but his thick eyebrows and pointed military mustache were as black as the night from which Ransford had come. His eyes, too, were black and very bright. He had high cheekbones, a sharp cut nose, a spare, dark face, the face of a man used to giving orders, the face of an aristocrat. Turning to the giant in uniform, the general made a sign. The giant put away his pistol, saluted, withdrew. "Ivan is an incredibly strong fellow," remarked the general, "but he has the misfortune to be deaf and dumb. A simple fellow, but I'm afraid, like all his race, a bit of a savage." "Is he Russian?" "He is Cossack," said the general, and his smile showed red lips and pointed teeth. "So am I." "Come," he said, "we shouldn't be chatting here. We can talk later. Now you want clothes, food, rest. You shall have them. This is a most restful spot." Ivan had reappeared, and the general spoke to him with the lips that moved but gave forth no sound. "Follow Ivan, if you please, Mr. Ransford," said the general. "I was about to have my dinner when you came. I'll wait for you. You'll find that my clothes will fit you, I think." It was a huge beam-ceiling bedroom with a canopied bed big enough for six men that Ransford followed the silent giant. Ivan laid out an evening suit, and Ransford, as he put it on, noticed that it came from a London tailor who ordinarily cut and sewed for none below the rank of duke. The dining room, to which Ivan conducted himself, was in many ways remarkable. There was a medieval magnificence about it. It suggested a baronial hall of feudal times with its oaken panels, its high ceilings, its vast rectory table where 20 men could sit down to eat. About the hall were the mounted heads of many animals, lions, tigers, elephants, moose, bears, larger or more perfect specimens Ransford had never seen. At the great table the general was sitting alone. "You'll have a cocktail, Mr. Ransford," he suggested. The cocktail was surprisingly good, and Ransford noted the table appointments were of the finest, the linen, the crystal, the silver, the china. They were eating borscht, the rich red soup with sour cream so dear to Russian palates. Half apologetically, General Zarov said, "We do our best to preserve the amenities of civilization here. Please forgive any lapses. We are well off the beaten track, you know. Do you think the champagne has suffered from its long ocean trip?" "Not in the least," declared Fransford. He was finding the general a most thoughtful and affable host, a true cosmopolite. But there was one small trait of the general's that made Ransford uncomfortable. Whenever he looked up from his plate, he found the general studying him, appraising him narrowly. "Perhaps," said General Zarov, "you were surprised that I recognized your name. You see, I read all books on hunting published in English, French, and Russian. I have but one passion in my life, Mr. Ransford, and it is the hunt." "You have some wonderful heads here," said Ransford, as he ate a particularly good cut, a well-cooked filet mignon. "That Cape Buffalo is the largest I ever saw." "Oh, that fellow, yes, he was a monster." "Did he charge you?" "Hurled me against a tree," said the general. "Fractured my skull, but I got the brute." "I've always thought," said Ransford, "that the Cape Buffalo is the most dangerous of all big game." For a moment, the general did not reply. He was smiling his curious red-lipped smile. Then he said slowly, "No, you're wrong, sir. The Cape Buffalo is not the most dangerous big game." He sipped his wine. "Here in my preserve, on this island," he said in the same slow tone, "I hunt more dangerous game." Ransford expressed his surprise. "Is there big game on this island?" The general nodded. "The biggest." "Really?" "Oh, it isn't here naturally, of course. I have to stock the island." "What have you imported, General?" Ransford asked. "Tigers?" The general smiled. "No," he said. "Hunting tigers ceased to interest me some years ago. I exhausted their possibilities, you see. No thrill left in tigers, no real danger. I live for danger, Mr. Ransford." The general took from his pocket a gold cigarette case and offered his guest a long black cigarette with a silver tip. It was perfumed and gave off a smell like incense. "We will have some capital hunting, you and I," said the general. "I shall be most glad to have your society." "But what game?" began Ransford. "I'll tell you," said the general. "You will be amused, I know. I think I may say, in all modesty, that I have done a rare thing. I have invented a new sensation. May I pour you another glass of port, Mr. Ransford?" "Thank you, General." The general filled both glasses and said, "God makes some men poets. Some he makes kings, some beggars. Me he made a hunter. My hand was made for the trigger," my father said. "He was a very rich man with 250,000 acres in Crimea, and he was an ardent sportsman. When I was only 5 years old, he gave me a little gun, specially made in Moscow for me to shoot sparrows with. When I shot some of his prized turkeys with it, he did not punish me. He complimented me on my marksmanship. I killed my first bear in the Caucasus when I was 10. My whole life has been one prolonged hunt. I went into the army. It was expected of noblemen's sons, and for a time commanded a division of Cossack cavalry. But my real interest was always the hunt. I have hunted every kind of game in every land. It would be impossible for me to tell you how many animals I have killed." The general puffed at his cigarette. "After the debacle in Russia, I left the country, for it was imprudent for an officer of the Tsar to stay there. Many noble Russians lost everything. I luckily had invested heavily in American securities, so I shall never have to open a tea room in Monte Carlo or drive a taxi in Paris. Naturally, I continued to hunt grizzlies in the Rockies, crocodiles in the Ganges, rhinoceroses in East Africa. It was in Africa that the Cape Buffalo hit me and laid me up for 6 months. As soon as I recovered, I started for the Amazon to hunt jaguars, for I had heard they were unusually cunning." "They weren't," the Cossack sighed. "They were no match for a hunter with his wits about him and a high-powered rifle. I was bitterly disappointed. I was lying in my tent with a splitting headache one night when a terrible thought pushed its way into my mind. Hunting was beginning to bore me. And hunting, remember, had been my life. I've heard that in America, businessmen often go to pieces when they give up the business that has been their life. Yes, that's so, said Ransford. The general smiled. I had no wish to go to pieces, he said. I must do something. Now, mine is an analytical mind, Mr. Ransford. Doubtless that is why I enjoy the problems of the chase. No doubt, General Zaroff. So, continued the general, I asked myself why the hunt no longer fascinated me. You are much younger than I am, Mr. Ransford, and have not hunted as much. But you perhaps can guess the answer. What was it? Simply this. Hunting had ceased to be what you call a sporting proposition. It had become too easy. I always got my quarry, always. There is no greater bore than perfection. The general lit a fresh cigarette. No animal had a chance with me anymore. That is no boast. It is a mathematical certainty. The animal had nothing but his legs and his instinct. Instinct is no match for reason. When I thought of this, it was a tragic moment for me, I can tell you. Ransford leaned across the table, absorbed in what his host was saying. It came to me as an inspiration what I must do, the general went on. And that was? The general smiled, the quiet smile of one who has faced an obstacle and surmounted it with success. I had to invent a new animal to hunt, he said. A new animal? You're joking. Not at all, said the general. I never joke about hunting. I needed a new animal. I found one. So I bought this island, built this house, and here I do my hunting. The island is perfect for my purposes. There are jungles with a maze of trails in them, hills, swamps, but the animal, General Zaroff. Oh, said the general, it supplies me with the most exciting hunting in the world. No other hunting compares with it for an instant. Every day I hunt, and I never grow bored now, for I have a quarry with which I can match my wits. Ransford's bewilderment showed in his face. I wanted the ideal animal to hunt, explained the general, so I said, what are the attributes of an ideal quarry? And the answer was, of course, it must have courage, cunning, and above all, it must be able to reason. But no animal can reason, objected Ransford. My dear fellow, said the general, there is one that can. But you can't mean, gasped Ransford. And why not? I can't believe you're serious, General Zaroff. This is a grisly joke. Why should I not be serious? I'm speaking of hunting. Hunting, General Zaroff, what you speak of is murder.